Welcome to Lab, the podcast. We are uncovering enchanted reality through conversations with people whose lives and work give us a glimpse of the life and beauty of the gospel. We're so glad you're joining us for the conversation. Lab, the podcast starts right now. Hey, welcome to Lab, the podcast. Grateful to have the opportunity to share some time with Andrew Balio. Andrew served as a principal trumpet for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. That's where he's been since his invitation in 2001. He served as he's the former principal of the Israel Philharmonic, has played all over the world, and a well-accomplished musician. Andrew's interest in orchestral affairs and challenges began when he was a music student all the way back renting a room from the Boston Symphony's longtime chair, and from there has traveled the world and is one of those people who, when you get a chance to talk to him, and I did have a chance prior to the recording this to spend some time, and almost in any direction can learn from you, Andrew. So thank you so much for giving up some time to spend with us. We're really grateful.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've been very excited about our talk today.
Well, I first was introduced to your work through an essay that was titled Building Communities with Music, and that was the opening address for the Future Symphony Institute, and that was back in 2018, but I found my way to that essay last year, and from there, I ended up going to the Foundation for the Future of Classical Music and your work to orchestrate a renaissance in classical music. So that was my way into your work, and since then, I've learned a ton from you, from your writing, from the foundation, and I couldn't wait to get some time to just talk about modernity and music and beauty, and there's so many different ways we could go, so I'm going to rely on Riley to keep our time so I don't burn up your entire day. I know you had a full morning of rehearsal, but why don't you start by just taking us in and give us a quick overview of your work at the Foundation for the Future of Classical Music and why that's important to you to orchestrate a renaissance in classical music.
Thank you. Well, I've been an orchestral musician for the last 40 years, playing professionally, as you pointed out, around the world. And I got to experience the way classical music has really taken root in the hearts of not only people in the New World, America, which, you know, America inherited this from Europe. But when I was in Mexico, touring throughout South and Central America, playing with the Israel Philharmonic, touring around the world with them in the Far East in particular, I saw that there was a universal quality to classical music that just reached human beings in a certain way, unlike any other kind of music that exists. It's entirely unique among civilizations. But at the same time, what I'd been hearing ever since I was a student was that classical music was dying. Classical music is dying, and it's getting there's all this doom and gloom going on. And so it was always at the back of my mind that maybe I was on borrowed time, and maybe I'd be very lucky to even finish my career as a classical musician, if I would even be so lucky as to have a career in classical music, which one can never count on at the beginning. Yet here I am, 40 years later, professional playing, and it's going quite strong. Yet there are problems. And I was struck by the fact that there were no institutions focusing on treating classical music like an endangered species, just the way we protect the whales, and which is fantastic that we stepped in before they were gone, and or any of these other types of unprotected wildlife or cultural heritages. We see that around the world, governments or NGOs having to step in to protect some aspect of cultural patrimony. And so I decided to at least start this institution that stands for the future of classical music itself, flourishing for generations to come. And if someone else were doing this, I would step aside and just stick to playing trumpet, because I am not a born administrator, but I'm simply looking forward to the day when I can hand this off to much younger and more capable people than myself. So that's our efforts right now, is to try to build larger and larger communities of interested people, both young and old, who are very concerned about the future of classical music, which in a sense, it really is kind of in danger right now because of all the seismic changes going on in the world. I don't have to enumerate them, but I think everyone agrees that we're experiencing unprecedented change. And what can happen when nobody's looking is things that are intrinsically very valuable to us, things that we agree are extremely important, can get swept away in really just a generation. And so I think someone has to keep a conversation, not only monitoring that, but talking about what's working and how are we going to adapt to new realities.
Yeah. Well, it's when I discovered that from the Future Symphony of an Institute over to...
That's our former name.
Yeah.
People weren't very clear about what the Future Symphony Institute was. They thought, well, is that a new orchestra? The Orchestra of the Future? No. Okay, it's the Foundation for the Future of Classical Music. So I changed the name, and a lot of people thanked me for changing the name, because we should not be ambiguous.
Yeah. No, I loved it. That move was really important, because I think what you're describing, without having an institute that is saying there's something important here, that's what struck me. In our work, we have been tracing this line of kind of the disenchantment of the Western world, especially related to the idea that, you know, it's anthropocentric versus theocentric. Is it a world that we're at the center of designing reality, or is reality something that is there that we're nested within? That's the conversation for so many of us. And when I discovered your work, I thought, much like Dana Gioia, who is working in poetry and saying there's something about poetry that coheres with reality. And if we lose poetry, if we lose our ability to traffic in that language, there's something fundamentally human in the way that we communicate in beautiful language and musical language. And if we lose that, we've lost something about what it is to be a human. That's why I got so excited about your work. And I want to pull on that thread and just invite you to have some open space to talk about that, because that idea that reality is musical, that's a whimsical thing to say. But at the root and foundation, it seems that classical music tells the story of an ordering of music that does cohere with reality, and even the idea of the music of the spheres. So unpack that a little bit. Is reality musical, right? How would you answer that?
Well, we live in a ordered universe, and we like things that we can apprehend with our minds and hearts, things that make sense to us, that reflect the beauty of the cosmos that we live in. And that's art for thousands of years has always sought to mirror that higher order. And what's became a big problem is when we departed from that, mandate to keep finding new ways of reflecting the beauty that we see around us in nature and the universe. You mentioned Dana Gioia's work in defending poetry. You know, poetry is a very good example, a great cautionary tale, because poetry was something that actually was found in cultures all around the world, and something that was practiced, as people would memorize these great poems, and poems were meant as metaphors, very multi-layered but yet ordered ways of describing a reality that can't quite be pinned down in words. So is in a sense poetry was like musical language. Yet what the great undoing for poetry, because we know poetry is utterly vanished in our lives, well, why is that? Because it went from being sensical, being beautiful, ordered, and apprehendable by not only young minds but everybody, if they, you know, put in a little bit of work to kind of think about that poem. What does it really mean? And people, the postmodernism came and gave us a bunch of gibberish. And that was my first experience of poetry. I mean, I would just be, these teachers would put some recent poem, some 20th century poem, and it made no sense to me. There was no way, there was nothing in it. My young mind, of course, you know, of course I was probably a pretty lazy student, but it did not resonate with me, and I rejected it. So poetry is utterly absent in my mind, in my life, as a result. And that could very well be the case with classical music if we kept following the same postmodernist script. What happened with art? You know, we all know we've seen plenty of gibberish art that doesn't seem to say anything. It just, the claim is simply it means whatever you think it means. And then classical music has been trying to replicate that whole same move. By creating a type of avant-garde music that they say is part of the classical trajectory, and this is music that also does not make any sense. People listen to it. I mean, I go through this all the time. Without leading the witness, I ask audience members what they thought of a particular piece, or there was, you know, this avant-garde off the wall, you know, work of, you know, sounds like, you know, banging pots and pans and, you know, and all sorts of extraneous, weird moaning sounds. And the first reaction is that they're afraid to voice what they really think. So they say, well, that was interesting. It's kind of like when someone cooks something for you and it's really bad, but you eat it out of, you know, being polite. You say, oh, so did you like the, you know, did you like the soy loaf I made for you? And then you say, oh, it was interesting, you know. So that's what's happened with partly the part of the story of classical music for the last 60 years after World War II is they've gone down this path of gibberish.
Yeah.
But of course, classical music is doing great. Why? Why is classical music doing so well? Because we were saved by our audiences. Our audiences are the ones who were so insistent that they wanted to hear the most beautiful music, the time-honored, you know, works, whatever it is that they loved. They voted with their feet in their pocketbooks, and they're the ones that are keeping us alive. Because if it was up to the bureaucratic mandarins of classical music, nobody would be listening to Beethoven anymore. They would have vanquished it. So
yeah. No, it's from my seats as just a very, very cheap seats, not participating in creating music and making music. We know what tastes good, just like you described with food. Like as a consumer, as somebody who enjoys music, we know what tastes good. And then as somebody from a theological space, it makes sense to me, even as I hear, like, you'd do some of the reading about Pythagoras's idea of ratio and tone and the corresponding numbers, and you start going down those trails, and it actually is magnificent. You go, wow, this really does point to an ordered, designed, beautiful world that I get to participate in. And I find that wonderful and wondrous. And yet I hear what you're saying, that if you were to raise your hand and disagree with music that does not correspond to your palate, like just naturally, it's not beautiful, it doesn't seem to be coherent with reality. If you were to raise a hand and say, I don't know, it doesn't seem interesting to me, it seems ugly. It seems like, you know, you're bombarded with you're the problem, and you just don't understand art, because art became self-expression, was the highest good, right? Like it doesn't matter what we're making as long as you're true to yourself. Did you?
Well, yeah, they sort of pile at that point, they hand you the hipster dictum, which is you just don't get it.
Yes. Yeah. Which is.
And, yeah. Yeah. So really what we're talking about is music that music that speaks to human nature, you know, or food that's that is that you know is to human nature. Is you know, there's certain foods that we, you know, things that we that delight us and we want more of and we enjoy and whatnot. And of course, you know, the metaphor sort of breaks down at certain points, but I think the key phrase is human nature. And it's human nature to love beauty. It's human nature to want to be happy. I think that's probably the most important thing for us to remember in art, is that even the art that delves into dark, painful things, it gives us a cathartic opportunity for redemption of that pain. It's not the great art that is dark and you know, painful is also giving us a sense of catharsis, and we get through it and we find the whole thing beautiful. I mean, some of the most beautiful music is dark and difficult, as I was saying. So it's you know, not to reduce the purpose of music is just to make people happy, but it's there's something more complex. And so wrestling with difficult but beautiful scriptures gives us a sense of redemption in the end, and wrestling with beautiful objects, whatnot, that is where we get a sense of meaning in our lives. So that I think it's that process of us investing ourselves in something. I mean, just, you know, have that Persian rug up on the wall is something that I just love to look at, because it just entirely describes the numinous and the very things you're talking about, with the fundamental Pythagorean insight into that we are in an ordered universe, and it's through numbers that we can learn more about how the whole thing is put together. Now, I just wanted to say something about Pythagoras. He did make a fundamental insight into tones and pitches and ratios, and that there's numbers that correspond to these pitches. What he did was that he made an adjustment over what's called the harmonic series to divide this octave into 12 separate notes that were equally spaced apart. So they don't actually naturally come up quite that way. So these are this is the beautiful thing about mankind intervening in nature and to make something very beautiful through that. And it's because of that fundamental insight that he had that allowed Western music to have its own language of harmony that migrates between all these different keys and that's what we've been exploring for, you know, 1500 years, is applying that Pythagorean insight. And it took quite some time. It took some centuries, but it was done methodically, and it was done in the spirit that you described, which is that our work in making music is to reflect the glory of God, and, you know, here on earth. So we were, you know, that was always the purpose of the arts, you know, 1500, at least, you know, we're going to go back 1500 years.
Yeah. Which it seems to me that when you describe your craft in a well-ordered thing, I mean, I don't know the exact number of people in a symphony, but to do something at that scale, where everyone is, their pitch and their tone is united, there's so much order and harmony that brings this unified experience that's an embodied thing that everybody's participating in together, where many are one. And there's something really remarkable about that and beautiful about achieving it. That, you know, that word will scare some people, but achieving like that level of excellence and pursuing something that can be known and a craft that can be disciplined and ordered. What do you say to the person who says, I hear you, but, you know, you're coming on this line of saying beauty's objective, and therefore there's an objective standard, and then we can rise to it, and then we can all work together to rise and to reach something beautiful together. That sounds well and good, but it really stifles creativity. It really stifles that self-expression idea that is the modern approach to art. How do you answer back and say it's not stifling? It's actually, that there's an open, almost endless lane of discovery that can happen within that ordered world. How do you answer that person who says, no, all of that about objective beauty stifles creativity?
Well, those are comments made by people who are not engaged in actually creating something. So even the most off-the-wall architects still have to have a structure, and there has to be a plan, and there has to be there has to be some underlying order to what they're trying to put together. It's through, again, where it comes back to human nature, where there are certain principles in any art form that we know work. We know when I say work, meaning that these were the practices that became traditions over the many centuries, things that just worked, and that we can keep building on this. So we're learning from the past and even trying to find something new that we could add to it if to possibly improve on things. So this is this whole idea of creativity, that requires total freedom. It just doesn't wash, because the creativity happens within constraints. A symphony orchestra tends to be, anywhere between 50 and 120 people on stage. If someone decides they're going to write a piece for symphony orchestra for, 900 people, does that make for more possibilities? Actually, it would probably just sound like the far end of an AM radio dial. It would just become this wash of sound. So we've learned through the ages how many strings we put on stage, how many trumpets. We have one trumpet on a part, 12 strings on a part, and so forth. So this is one, aspect of what the symphony orchestra was arrived at through enormous amount of trial and error. And it doesn't mean in the future someone may come up with some incredible new ideas for making incredibly beautiful things. But what would be driving that success would be putting beauty at the front of the process, and not some sort of mathematical mandate or some sort of just wanting to be different for the sake of being different.
Yeah. In your work to see this renaissance in classical music, I think it was Wisconsin is your home. Was that where you grew up?
Yes, I did. Yes.
So we have this idea, at least I have this idea that, okay, a guy like Andrew, who's participating in this and with your craft at your level, you probably can't, you were raised in Vienna by, parents who were saturated in the arts. And of course, right, you ended up here. But really, your story starts in Wisconsin. I wonder, take a second, if you can, go back there, because I think I see a link that one of the things I appreciate about you is that your interest seems to be to see the story of music and music education and participation in music recovered, so that it doesn't appear to be an elitist thing that's sequestered in its own little silo. And your own story tells a really different story. So how did you get into music? And maybe take us back to Wisconsin. And where does your thread go back to that? And maybe is that surprising to you even that you ended up where you ended up?
Well, yes. To my thinking, a renaissance for classical music would mean that every child would have an opportunity sort of baked into their childhood to learn to make some sort of music, the classical music as part of the foundation for them, along with the other important things that they need to learn. And they can do what they want with that, but they would, from then on, they would have a sense of ownership with music. All music that they would hear from then on, they would be able to you know, capture in their minds and understand and appreciate more. All my upbringing in Wisconsin was simply just like all the other kids. It's the kind of opportunity that I wish all the other kids had in this country at this point. Unfortunately, it's been taken away from most of them. And the only reason why I play classical music is because I showed up in sixth grade on the first day, and we had 1 hour of our daily schedule where we had to show up in either the band room or the choir room. So I showed up in the band room, and then band director asked me, what instrument do I want to play? And I said, I'll play a cornet. Handed me his horribly rusty old cornet, probably World War II surplus or something. But I had a cornet in my hand, my own. And from then on, every single day in school, we played in our band for 1 hour of the day. And by 3 o'clock, we were released from school. There weren't any special remedial readings classes or any, we didn't, you know, there was enough time in the day to do everything. And somehow we've lost that. That was life in a public school in Wisconsin in the, you know, 1970s, 1980s. It was considered a self-evident truth that classical music was a self, you know, was a intrinsic good, that of course kids have to play some music. It's just like, of course, it made sense to these people. And my parents, I think what was wonderful about them is while they were Americans, they had a strong sense of looking back to old Europe as a guide for what is good and what's important to learn. And I think what made America really work was that focus on replicating all the best practices from the old world, from old Europe. And then, of course, we innovated and brought public education to far more children than the Europeans were able to do. So we actually had the gold standard for many years of public education. And in Europe, music was a set aside, a thing that, you know, kids might do based, you know, from the home or outside the home. Well, we were the ones who put it into the school curriculum. And so that was something that we did extremely well in the past, and we could do it again.
Yeah. I think about that with, you know, I am imagining your sixth grade band or choir choice. And I was in the 90s when I was in that same stretch. And for me, it was even then, the expectation was that you were going to participate in band or choir, and you maybe didn't love it, but everybody got a little bit of an exposure to band or choir. And you had a band room that was a pretty large band room with instruments supplied to it. And it seems like, yeah, just like with architecture, and that we talk about this in terms of disenchantment, that the architecture becomes ugly, the poetry goes away, there's not music in schools, we're educating to the test so that you can go and be a part of a working system, and it's a total work culture. And philosophically, you just go, well, okay, ideas have consequences, and people feel that. I believe that a younger generation is kind of waking up, and I think that's why your work is so exciting in this moment, because I think there's so many of us going, okay, I think we were told something about reality that isn't true. And those ideas have been shown to be bankrupt. And now we're standing around in a really disenchanted landscape trying to find our way back. And so we're looking to faith and saying, is there something good, true, and beautiful beyond us? Is there anything transcendent? And there's a lot of people that are not willing to say, I believe in, you know, a Judeo-Christian God or a particular God, but I'm willing to say I want open transcendence again. And that move then says, I want beauty again. And there's and then the next question is, well, what does that even mean? Right. And it seems like your work and the foundation's work to say beauty is knowable, and it does, there is a sensibleness to beauty. You can make sense of it, and you can apprehend it. You can participate in it. It seems to me that although it's were early, right? And I think that that shift is taking place. I think it is taking place. And I think that the death of atonal music and then a return back to desiring beautiful music, you know, that seems to be the wind pointing in that direction. Do you feel that same spirit kind of opening up, that there is a return? Like you said, people saying classical music's dead, but it never really died. And I think there's actually a greater interest and a growing interest. Would you say that you agree with that? Do you sense that in a younger generation, that there's a growing hunger and thirst for it?
Well, what I can say to that, the several points that you made, was that classical music lives on in the ears of millions, if not billions, of people through their watching of movies, you know, all these streaming movies, you know, Netflix. Every one of these movies, if they're any good at all, uses music to drive the emotions of the viewer. So what we have here is a situation in a movie. A movie has a certain character, or there's a certain emotional contour that the director wants to bring you through, and they find music that correlates to that. So there is a human nature connection. You don't see movies where it's about one thing and they have all this completely opposite music going on. It would work against the purpose of the movie to take you through a story. So classical music isn't necessarily about a story. In fact, most of the time it isn't about a particular story, but it's more of a non-linear description of a higher ordered thing that an aesthetic object that we're wanting to contemplate for a certain period of time. So it requires active listening and simply contemplating over whatever stretch of time is required. The great thing about modern art is that you can walk into the MoMA, take a look at a Rothko, and then you can walk on and 20 seconds later and you got it. You got enough. I don't know many people who just stare at these objects in the MoMA for very long, and that, from at least what I've seen, some of these exhibits are kind of immersive and they're kind of cool, but this is what you when we spoke about the re-enchantment of our society. I think that certainly the younger generations now, they know they got shorted. They know, and I really envy nothing about their childhoods. What I had was way better. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't from being in a moneyed family or anything like that. It was just a standard issue American childhood in a good, in a safe town. And, you know, things have, I do think there's a lot of demand for a return to something that they don't even know. All they know is that it was more wholesome, it was safer, it was more beautiful, and there seemed to be more time in the day. There wasn't this huge rush to pass this bureaucratic test. And I think so. You spoke about atonalism. Atonalism was. There was certainly a sincere quest on the part of Schoenberg and some of these other truly fine genius composers to find something else, you know, a new terrain for what we call classical music to go into, tonality. That's what they were wrestling with, is tonality and how notes not only stack up, but how they move through time. And but most of that whole atonal movement was simply an effort to displace the old regime, the old order. It was competing with, frankly, you know, music that was just so unbelievably accomplished and beautiful that it was just paralyzing for composers by the time we got into the 20th century. In fact, Brahms, of all people, he talked about the incredible burden it was to have this specter of Beethoven in his mind, sitting on his shoulders, you know, looking over him. He found it paralyzing to even write a symphony, his first symphony, because the standard was set so high. So this, in order, rather than competing with these extraordinarily high standards that were achieved not only between Bach and let's say the late Romantic era, they said, we're just going to tear up. We want to tear up the whole thing. We're going to propose a whole new approach to that will, that is in a sense, a rejection of the past. So this sounds very familiar. The toppling of statues, trying to displace whatever came before. And that's much of what we see in modern architecture, is that it doesn't even try to compete with the beauty of the old beautiful buildings. They just say, we're just going to have no ornament. We're just going to have these, it's just, you know, we're just going to put up these glass boxes, and it's going to be a statement. And, you know, and it's just sort of a shtick. Mm. And but certainly, let me go back to human nature and look at people where you don't see people going on these, you know, taking time to go on vacation to visit these big shiny glass cities. They'd rather go to Florence, Rome, you know, the nicer parts of London, et cetera, Paris, and they want to go see, be in these really beautiful environments. Again, human nature bearing its beautiful head again, seeking beauty.
Yeah.
And so so atonalism was just one stage. I think atonalism isn't such a thing anymore. Many composers have retreated from that, but now we have a new type of movement that's taken the place of atonality, which is what we call banality. We have this idea of that it's sort of snarkiness and just being so music that's just so glib and non-expressive that it just sort of, it's just frankly, it's just really, really boring. But that's become the new trend, to just make music that's again, you know, like what we see with a lot of modern art. They put a clever title on it. The new music is very, very dependent on the title that's attached to it in order to lead the listener to draw that there's some sort of meaning to all this. You know, this may be tonal sounds, but we're kind of back to the same problem. And the problem is that it's just boring. That was the problem with atonality, 12 tone music and whatnot. It was just boring most of the time. So people got very impatient with it. And that's sort of where we are with a lot of the new music now, at least the new music that's being performed it's just not interesting. I mean, but there's plenty of composers out there fighting mightily to be heard, who write some very beautiful music that you'd want to hear again. You could listen to it. That's worth another listen. And I think that's one of the definitions of classical music that I like, is music that that encourages, you know, repeated listening. And the more you listen to it, the more things you learn, you get out of it, that you, it actually increases its you know, the things it gives you.
Yeah. I'm excited for what's to come. It's encouraging to hear you say that there's lots of composers that are working hard to participate in something that is beautiful and good and points beyond and is ordered. And I'm just curious, I know I want to respect your time, but for the church, it seems, you know, you see these great movements of art visually or even with music, and the church was actually participating at a really high level in the arts. What can the church do now? What would be some of the strongest things that the church itself could do now in the West to kind of help catalyze or to resource this renaissance in classical music?
Yeah, well, that's been the big question for so many Christians of all denominations, is how to lead a good life outside of the church. I mean, outside of, you know, other than Sunday, you know, is what are we doing the rest of the days of the week? And the challenge has been to find really wholesome pursuits and interests, not only for our children, but for ourselves as adults, in things that are congruent with our commitments to our religion. And classical music is that art form. It is a Christian art form. Classical music is Christian music. Even if it's not sacred music, you know, like a requiem or a mass or something like that, it still comes out of this Christian worldview that prioritizes beauty, truth, and goodness as intrinsic goods. It's a trinity. It's three things at once that exist as one object, as one idea. It's a kind of a meme that illuminates, Christian, all manner of Christian arts. And if Christians would reconnect with classical music, I think they would get an enormous amount of gratification, because it would, in a sense, give them a place for exploring their emotions and experiencing the emotions of these great composers who are wrestling with these transcendent and sacred ideas that that the church was working on too, and trying to get things that we face in our daily lives. It's very abstract. It's not, we always want to pin things down to something that's exact or that we can prove, that's provable. But it doesn't stop me from trying to make assertions that that there's so much there for so many people in this. Yes, it requires some patience, or rather stilling the mind. I think the recent trend of being interested in mindfulness, certainly meditation, and there's certainly many people who are very religious who found that quieting their minds as a practice was extremely beneficial for their prayer life. That state of mind is very helpful for apprehending classical music. And so I think these are natural bedfellows. I think that the people who have religious commitments will find in classical music something that's very much congruent with the things that they hold true and valuable, as part of their value system. And conversely, to the classical music community, when we talk about wanting to find new audiences, that's our new audience. That's the audience that hasn't been coming. So I've observed that there's this big disconnect between the people with religious commitments, particularly Christian religious commitments, and classical music. Why aren't you two together? Yeah. Because classical music a long time ago became the, in a sense, sort of surrounded and occupied and kind of controlled by the countercultural left. And so, to be in charge of a cultural institution meant to be part of the counterculture. They're raised on this whole idea that high culture is something that needs to be knocked off of its pedestal and brought down to the people. Whereas if it was on any pedestal, that wasn't keeping it from people. The people who they claim to speak for were always free to attend and not attend, and many times they did. But this whole culture war paradigm has been very destructive certainly for classical music, and it kept out all these people who had allergies to anything that smelled like counterculture, culture war, that whole shtick. And then we sit here with half empty concert halls and woefully deciding that we're not going to play the very music that we know that Christians would really enjoy. Mm-hmm. we wouldn't want to make them happy.
I love it. I think that's where I get so excited. Again, back to Dana Joy, if you want better poets, you need better audiences. And I love what you just said, Andrew, that there's an opportunity here for everybody across denominational lines to recognize. I love what you said, the statement that classical music is Christian music. And again, not because we're lacing it with a particular ideology, the reality of the music itself and the way that it's structured, the way that it's ordered is based on a reality that coheres with the world that has a God who is beautiful, who designed it. So if you're it literally
came out of a Christian civilization that no longer exists. And what we are the inheritors right now in 2024 of many of the fruits of this Christian civilization, but it's no longer a Christian civilization anymore. So what we're looking at is a music of the past that came out of another time, another place, but yet it's still beautiful. People still wait in line for 2 to 3 hours to get into the Vatican.
Yeah,
they just want to be. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And there, I don't know how many people are not Catholics who are waiting in that line, but people, they may hate the Catholic Church, but they still want to see the inside of the Vatican. Yeah. And so one doesn't have to sign up for any of these other commitments to love classical music. But if you want to understand it, you're going to have to accept that these, all of these composers that we're going to call classical composers, meaning, which kind of takes us up to World War II and some, maybe 20, 30 years after World War II, where people are still writing according to this beauty, truth, and goodness principle. They were in a Christian milieu.
Yeah.
Even if they were, a few of them were avowed agnostics or even atheists, but they were still playing in that arena because they wanted in. So many people have conflicting commitments. They're committed to beautiful music, or they're committed to one thing, and then they also have these political or theological ideas. But they, if we were, 10,000 years from now, when archaeologists are trying to understand this thing called classical music, not the avant-garde music, but this thing called classical music that they're trying to classify as such, they're going to say, well, it came out of this thing called Christendom, yeah, which we later called Western civilization, and which eventually fizzled out and became something else.
Yeah. Well, it's that right there is the reason that I was so excited about this conversation and just the resource that you're providing, even in time over coffee like this, for all of us who are raising kids, who are participating in culture, who are participating in our churches. There's something to think well about. So thank you for that. And we want to cheer on the work of the Foundation for the Future of Classical Music. Right now, just very quickly, what's the most impactful way that people can help be wind at the back for what you all are trying to do? Is it funding? Is it awareness? Is it just connections and continuing to keep your work out in front? What can we do to help kind of point to, celebrate, and champion your work?
Well, I thank you for asking. Of course, we are still in a rather startup phase. I still work as a full-time trumpet player in a symphony orchestra, but it's very much my hope to eventually get a staff. And I've had many people working to help me along the way, and they sort of come and go as they have time. But I would like to grow this into a fully staffed, fully operational research organization that defends classical music and really works on the big questions that face classical music. So if you come to our website, ffclassicalmusic.org, I would love it if people just read our articles. And then, of course, donations are more than welcome. Or if you have any thoughts about how we might be able to fundraise, or people that you want to connect us with, of course, I love getting those emails. And that's really how it's been going. It's just been very much a word of mouth, grassroots effort. And it's been very, very successful. We've achieved our goals with our various projects along the way. And I think we are at the point where we are very much ready to grow.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you. We're an ally, and we're everybody listening, do go to the website and you'll find a rich resource. I love reading the articles. There's a ton there. There's a piece on a film that is being worked on. So go to the website, find it as a resource. And I would just ask, like, pray for, cheer on, champion in any way you can the work that Andrew is doing. And Andrew, know that we're in your corner in our work to uncover enchanted reality and point to a God who is beyond and is the good and true and beautiful source. I don't know if there's a more important, you know, other than paralleling poetry, I think you're at the center of it. So we're cheering you on. Thank you for the time today. Thanks for your work. And we're in your corner for sure.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, we'll do it again. Thanks for joining us for the conversation. Remember to like and subscribe to Lab the Podcast and visit VUVIVO.com to help us uncover enchanted reality. We'll see you next time.